setup, it's a setup, it's a setup, there's a poem, it's a setup, it's a setup, it's a setup, there's a poem, it's a setup. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Third Degree Burn. I'm your host, Kirk Greenfield, and I'm joined with the usual cast of panelists. We're going to go somewhat clockwise here according to my screen. We have joining us Tim Elliott.
Hello.
Brian Hughes.
Howdy-ho.
Fred West.
Hello.
And I believe, Nigel, are you there?
I'm here, yes, hello.
And I've skipped over one other person here. Join in, mystery guest.
Hey, everyone, this is John.
All right. I miscounted here. We have a total of six people on the panel here. Just before we get started, I have a couple of very brief announcements. Since the last time that we recorded, a couple of things have occurred. First of all, I got a new computer system, so hopefully it will be much more clear, and I apologize to the folks for being the stick in the mud who didn't upgrade for the longest period of time. So a tip of the hat to my daughter. Thank you very much. That's one thing. Second, I'm within 2 weeks of retiring, so this gift is also not only a Father's Day gift, but also probably a happy retirement. So that's coming. It means I should have more time to do podcasts like this. Similar, you know, in the future. And the third thing that is perhaps even more important, there was a gathering of the freaks. As you may know, we're part of the Two True Freaks Network, and they frequently have annual gatherings down in Florida. Well, Third Degree Burn held a get-together in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I think about 80% of our members showed up. Brian, would you like to share anything about that?
Yeah, we had a great time here. I actually live here in DFW in Saginaw, Texas, and I invited everybody from the Third Degree Burn podcast as well as many, many others to come down. Given the time that we did it, really, it was just Third Degree Burn that came out here. Nigel flew all the way from Japan. He'd never been to the States before, so it was wonderful. Yeah, I mean, just I hope he had a great experience and all that. We also had Fred and John coming from San Diego. Tim and his wife, Vanula, of course, came in from Las Vegas. And then my wife, son, and Nestor here did everything we could to give everybody a nice experience here.
Oh, you did?
We had almost everybody except for Tim and Vanula here in the X-Mansion, as, as Kirk likes to call it. And we went comic book shop hopping. We went on a comic shop crawl, tried to go across a DFW Metroplex, but we spent so much time at the stores that we went to, we were only able to hit like 13 stores. But even with that, we did a lot of shopping, a lot of buying, a lot of having fun. And hopefully we've given Nigel some new experiences that he can take with him wherever he goes.
And yes, the amazing thing is, they not only let him in the country, but they let him out of the country with those those several suitcases full of U.S. comic books without paying any tariff.
That's true, yeah.
All right, I guess we should get to business here. We are gathered today in the site of the Two True Freaks emblem to cover Alpha Flight number 11. And this is the beginning of one of the major turning points in the series. Hard to spoil something that's been out for more than 40 years, but I'm being very careful. We've been fairly cautious up to this point not to spoil what's coming for those of you who are not familiar with the tale. However, this is almost the penultimate issue, pretty close to it. Tim, did you say that you had the summary for this, the synopsis?
I do.
No.
All right.
Get going.
All right. Alpha Flight, issue number 11. Our writer is John Byrne. Our artist, John Byrne. Colorist is Andy Yankus. Our letterer is Michael Hickens. Our editor-in-chief is Denny O'Neill and Linda Grant. And Jim Shooter is editor-in-chief. It's at a cover date of June 1984 with an on-sale date of March 20th, 1984. 32 pages, cost 60 cents. This has two stories in it. It's got our main story, and it's got the conclusion of our backup origin stories. The other Byrne worked during the same month was he's still a writer-artist on Fantastic Four number 267. He did the cover art for Power Man Iron Fist number 106, and he is the writer on The Thing issue 13. First story is called Setup. In Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, Delphine Courtney recruits Roger Box for her project. The Box has his own thoughts on the plan and secretly attempts to contact Guardian. In Ottawa, Heather Hudson bids a wistful goodbye to her home of 10 years to move to a new home in New York. In New York, in a top office in one of the towers of the World Trade Center, the former Beta and Gamma Flight members that Courtney recruited are meeting their benefactor, Jerome Jackson. He reveals his motivation for forming their team as revenge against James Hudson and Alpha Flight for ruining their prospects. At the airport, Hudson goes to pick up his arriving wife, but finds Jackson's calling card instead. Realizing his job with Roxon has all part of Jackson's revenge plan, and now that his wife has been taken hostage, he flies straight to the tower where Jackson's messages direct him. Believing his force will protect him from whatever Jackson throws at him, he is surprised to be confronted with a newly formed Omega Flight. To be continued. Our backup story, which is the conclusion of our Alpha Flight origins, is entitled Unleash the Beast. Walter Lankowski was a friend of Bruce Banner's in college nearly two decades ago. Since then, he sought to follow in Banner's footsteps in gamma research. Three of the intervening years were spent playing pro football, but when the news broke 3 years ago that Banner was the Hulk, he rededicated himself to his research. He got a job at Department H and secured a private lab in the Arctic Circle to experiment in creating a gamma-enhanced being, like the Hulk, under controlled circumstances. Now when he finally applies his findings to himself, he transforms into a furry orange beast and goes on a rampage. Snowbird flies in to check on Walter and worries that the experiments have the potential to unleash the great beast imprisoned beneath the region. By then, Walter has returned to his human form. She finds him lying in the snow at the end of his trail of destruction and takes him to Dr. Michael to Youngman. During his recovery, Lankowski wonders which factors, be it abnormal cosmic ray activity or his own unique biology, may have contributed to his transformation, breaking from the predicted model. Snowbird takes the responsibility of training him to master his beastly other self. James Hudson tells him he'll need both forms when they return to the mission of reclaiming Wolverine from the X-Men. The end.
Very good.
Yeah, well, that's straight from the wiki. So I didn't write that. But,
I've got to tell you, I was a little bit surprised because I did not recall that this issue is split almost exactly in half, half being the setup for next issue and the other half being the conclusion of Sasquatch's origin. So
yeah.
I'm a little caught off guard.
It's 12 pages for the main story, 9 for the Sasquatch. So it's almost split in half.
The cover is generally one of those things that Stan Lee would have had fits over because there was an edict for years that you did not show the main character from behind. You had to see them from the front. And so he nixed a number of covers over the years because they showed the hero's butt. Now, whether this was his edict or whether it came from Martin Goodman, I'm not sure. But this one is basically a black cover, and it's got Guardian front and center facing away from the reader. And then in silhouette, we have various figures who I initially, when I picked this off the rack, I assumed that they were the X-Men. Just at a quick glance, because of the shape of some of the figures and the fact that there's a man in a wheelchair dead center, but they are all in silhouette. You can't see any details.
I was just saying, this cover actually inspired me in college. One semester I was directing a one-act play. I needed to make programs for it, and I needed to put something on the front cover. I didn't want anything elaborate. And I just happened to have this sitting on my couch because I planned on reading it. And I saw everybody in silhouette, and it gave me the play was impromptu, and it was about four different type of actors, you know, the ingenue, the snooty kind of guy. Anyway, it inspired me to go ahead and take a picture of them and have an artist outline them and put that onto the cover of the program for the play. And I actually impressed the professor. He thought that was quite interesting. So yeah, help me get an A.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting how simple the cover is, but when you look at some of the panels as you go through the issue, they're very elaborate. There's like extra detail in some of the panels. And I'm like, this cover is so simple, and it misleads you in like, oh, okay, the artwork's going to be a little simpler in this one or whatnot. But then you get into some of the panels, and like that very first panel, like the detail that's in the bookshelf behind Roger is like incredible.
Well, there's your credits.
Yeah, I think the credits are on the spine of those books.
I thought that was quite ingenious.
Well, the only...
They've done it a lot of times over the years, and that this is just one of Burns, but yeah,
he does that a lot.
Cool.
He likes to play with credits like that.
Is there anything on the drafting table in the left side of this splash page? I can't quite make it out without my glasses, but is there a signature of his hidden in the
could be.
In the doodles?
Mm. Could be.
They look like. They look like they could be signatures, but I can't read anything.
I'm wondering what that little tech thing is on the far left side of it, though. But
he's got little bits of tech all over the place. Just odds and ends. And
I like the tech junk bin under the desk. I have one of those currently.
It's just the first time we've seen Roger.
Yeah, I
think it's the first time we've seen him. We've seen Box, the robot Box, in the first issue.
Sorry, I took a picture of the drawing board, and I've been turning it around and everything, trying to see if I can make anything from the scribbles, but no.
I like the electrical socket right next to the front door. I think the Canadian Electricians Union might say something about that. It's literally right on the door jamb, and then there's 50 things plugged into it.
Well, my question was, I thought about the splash page, which I agree, Fred, is very, very detailed. How does Box get to anything on the top shelf of that bookcase unless... His wheelchair looks like it might be kind of custom made. It's a three-wheeler. Yeah. Maybe it raises up so he can get to the stuff on the top.
Just because we can't see the robot doesn't mean it's not there in the room. He probably phases into the robot and pulls stuff down off the top shelf.
Yeah, he's in the kitchen.
But he doesn't phase into the robot at this time. He has a cybernetic helmet. Yeah. But he might, because the next page, top panel, as we see Courtney walking away, he's in a second floor apartment, and it looks like there are steps. So how does he get down those steps in his wheelchair? It doesn't look like it's an ADA ramp.
His wheelchair. Yeah.
This is like 20 years before ADA compliance was an actual thing.
Or maybe he never leaves the apartment.
Well, don't we see him driving around in a van? So he's got to get down to that garage. There's probably an elevator in the garage that takes him up and down.
Exactly. Maybe it's internal and he gets down to the... I like the character of Box. I liked him a lot when he was introduced. I like the robot. I like him as being, one, he's a little overweight. He's disabled. He's missing his legs. So he's not your ordinary character. He's not like a Tony Stark. He's not a dashing playboy. He's a regular kind of pudgy genius tinkers around with this robot he's built.
Yeah, he definitely breaks the mold of what we think of as superheroes in the fact that he is disabled, that he is a little rounder and softer in a lot of ways than what we would expect the traditional heroes to look like.
And he's a ginger.
I'd say more than that, he's flaming red hair.
Yeah.
Now, as opposed to Heather...
Who's on the next page, she's more orange, I would say, as it's colored in my trade here.
Yeah.
What is y'all's impression of Delphine Courtney?
Very trendy.
When you first read it.
I don't know that I had any opinion of who she was when I first read it. I was like, I wasn't even like questioning any of her motivation at this point. She was just like, oh, okay, she's coming in. She's like a corporate headhunter kind of thing. I really didn't think anything particularly of her at this point.
Yeah, they don't give you much to work with. I agree, Fred.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she was at least the most stylish feminine character when she, you know, when she's introduced here. When you think of Aurora or even Heather, you know, they're, none of them dress as stylish as she does.
One's a nun and one's a
the goddess.
We would say a traditional housewife at this point, but yeah. You know, neither one of those two women are known for their style sense.
Yeah, that's true.
Or Jean-Marie is not known for her style sense. No. Aurora is, but not Jean-Marie.
She's known for her lack of style.
Yeah.
and we are given a little, I guess we could consider this a little bit of a hint, because as she walks away, Box is thinking out the window, says, what a strange woman, so beautiful and yet so cold, knowing what we know later. I'm not going to give anything away. But
yeah,
knowing where the story goes. Away.
Mm. Well, from when she first appeared, as you say, she's definitely the sort of smartest dressed female that we've seen so far in the issues, I think. Yeah, she's certainly got the looks and everything. She reminded me of sort of like a Disney evil princess type woman, because she's got the looks and everything, but you can tell that she's probably not a nice person inside.
Yeah. I think I just read her as a villain.
That's what I got.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's up to no good. Yeah.
And at this point, we don't really get a good.
She's a manipulator. Yeah.
We also haven't gotten a good close up of her. I mean, the two shots that we have of her are pretty far away. So you don't get a good look of what she actually looks like. You can kind of see her style and her clothes, but like you don't get a good shot of her face, really, at this point.
Have we not seen her before?
Yeah, I was going to say in previous issues.
Yeah, she recruited
we've
Smart
had a better look at her. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then page 7 here, you've got a close up of her face.
Oh, okay, yeah.
When they're introducing the Omega Flight members,
you don't get as good a shot of her as you do later.
What did you guys think of Heather and her memories as she walks through the empty house?
Well, I was going to ask you guys about the skyscraper image. Now, we've seen a little bit of this here in Alpha Flight, and we saw it in Fantastic Four at that same era, where it looked like Byrne was taking pictures of, you know, the various areas, and then I guess he would light box them.
I don't know if he's lightboxing them or if it's early Photoshop. He may be just tracing him.
But did you guys like that at the time? Did you find it interesting or did you find it a cheat? Or
I thought it was effective. I liked it. Yeah,
I did too. I thought it was appealing.
Yeah, I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool.
Yeah,
when I saw it, I was always trying to figure out how he did that. Mm-hmm. Not being, you know, type that does that kind of art or any kind of art, really. It makes it harder for a guy like me. And Heather getting ready to leave the home. Oh, that tile in the kitchen is so ugly. Is that really orange and black?
The floor.
Or is that like a wood parquet?
No, it's tile.
It'd be linoleum, probably.
It's linoleum.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is
hideous.
I
think it's the kitchen.
I think Mr. LaPierre, the downstairs neighbor and landlord, is going to be happy that they're gone with the Guardian flying in and out and all that stuff and the racket they must have caused upstairs. In this apartment, is this not where they have the secret closet with the computer that she summons Puck and Marina?
I believe so.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
Yeah, Department H came in and tricked that whole apartment out, and they're leaving, like, I've left apartments. I'm like, Department H has to come back and take all that equipment out of this room, out of this building.
I'm sure they have.
Yeah, they are. They probably did when they shut it down.
Well, she does when she's paying the landlord. She pays the next 4 months. So it something seemed to me that he's holding the apartment. He's not going to rent it until their lease runs out. So for the next 4 months, they could come and go, or if she says may have to come back. So maybe that allows Department H to go in there, strip out all their tech.
Mm-hmm. And she paid in cash. What's up with that?
That's what well,
it was probably $200 a month back then. It wasn't much.
But, well, I had a question on these. I kind of like these memories she's walking through, these blue thought bubbles. So it's stuff we haven't really been privy to. Some of it's with, obviously, with Logan. But the upper right panel, where she's walking into a room, and these are just snippets of conversation. I'm assuming it's her talking or remembering. It says, you don't understand. You understand, don't you, Mac? I've got 8 million brothers and sisters, and then he says, it's okay, honey. Really, if the Hudson line stops with me, what does it matter as long as I have you? Is that implying that they were trying to have kids but couldn't or something? Or weren't ready to have kids? Or
looks that way.
Well, I don't think that was Heather saying that about 8 million brothers and sisters.
Who is that? I think it's Logan? No?
Well, no, that's it could be Marina, but I don't think that the two bubbles are related.
We know Heather comes they were. From a large family, so it's not unusual for her to say, hey, I got... You know, and yes, she's being over dramatic with saying she's got 8 million, but she comes from a large family. We know this about her backstory. So she may not be rushing into wanting to raise a family. And keep in mind, she's only what, 20 year? Remember, she married Mac very young.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, she said 10 years. Where has it gone? That would mean if she's 20 here, she married when he was 10.
No, she said she's not even 30, so she's 27, 28, 29.
Yeah, I figured they married when she was 18.
Of course, the next page, it looks like they've got Wheelie in the chopper bunch, or Wheelie outside.
At least it's Wheelie.
Yeah.
I think that's a
I mentioned that, I think, in the letters pages, that they had caught it or recognized it. Mm-hmm. It went right past me. I didn't have a slightest clue what they were talking about.
Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch was a cartoon that John Byrne actually did a couple issues of for Charlton Comics. Wasn't it a cartoon on TV?
It was a Hanna-Barbera cartoon or something like that.
Yeah. And so
that was his first published work, right?
Some of it. There's a lot going back and forth. What's his first published work? So
Brian and I covered an issue of it with Scott Gardner.
Yep, years ago. In our index.
10 years to be exact.
Wow. Oh, we covered
that
one.
At the bottom of that page, do you take this that the destination that she's flying off to is the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center?
Or she's flying to New York.
I mean, she's flying to New York, but that's where Delphine Courtney and the rest are meeting at.
Okay.
At the Twin Towers.
Put a pin in this. I want to come back to this by the time we get to the last page. I just wanted to make sure we were all in agreement that these were the World Trade Center towers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I definitely agree with that.
It says they're the World Trade Center.
It says the World Trade Center.
Well, we've seen Smart Aleck before, but I don't think we've seen really other than just the one picture of Diamond Lil or Flashback or Wild Child.
Just the one they showed in the very first issue.
Right.
Or showed them as Beta Flight,
Or Gamma.
What was it? Gamma.
They were Gamma. Because Box says some of them never made it to Beta.
And we finally get to know all their names. Box, Diamond Lil, Flashback, Smart Aleck, and Wild Child. Who's got kind of Michael Morbius type nose.
Yeah, it's kind of there.
And Sabretooth, cross between that and Sabretooth.
Smart Aleck.
So he could be.
Looks like Larry Linville. Looks like Frank Burns.
Ferret face.
Yep.
Got a little bit more chin. That's funny. Yeah, I'm starting to figure out who Flashback reminds me of. I mean, obviously, there's a cross between Reed Richards, Doctor Strange, and Namor in the way that that face is drawn. It's like he reminds me of somebody else altogether different.
He looks like one of the guys from House of Mystery or House of... he looks like one of either Cain or Abel. I can't remember which one. But he looks like one of those guys.
Reminds me a little bit of Ra's al Ghul for some reason.
That too.
Yeah.
Because the way the hair flares out.
Yeah.
Then Jerome Jackson comes out and tells them that they're supposed to be there for the utter destruction of Alpha Flight. Did this reveal do anything for anybody here? Was there a kind of a or anything?
Not seeing their individual reactions, it didn't do anything for me. It was like, okay, he's setting the agenda. They're all nasty people. Next.
And those crazy eyes behind his glasses.
Well, it's funny because when I first read this and I saw his image, it made me think of an old Christopher Reeve in a wheelchair.
Oh.
And that's, I didn't think anything of it at the time. Years later, it kind of freaked me out. But he does, in a way, remind me of Christopher Reeve in the way his face is drawn.
Yes.
And, of course, it's because of the hair being done the way, because that's the way Reeve kind of let it flow at certain points.
Yeah. When Courtney first comes in the room to kind of interrupt Wildchild from killing Flashback, she thinks to herself, she says, the influencer is working perfectly. It's heightening their petty jealousies and phobias, priming them. Is this ever brought up again, or is this revisited? Do we know what this influencer, whatever this is, some kind of device maybe she has on her person that is, one, it's causing them to bicker amongst themselves, and it's also somehow subtly controlling them or influencing them?
I thought that this was in the room. Because they're already bickering when they're in this large conference room.
I just thought maybe it was something she had on her, because at the beginning of the story, Box says she's so confident when she was giving the proposal that she almost expected him to say yes, like everybody else had. So I thought maybe this was something maybe she was taking with her when she was meeting with these people to get them to agree to this meeting or to the plan.
Yeah, because I've never heard of an influencer being effective at anything. Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking about comics there.
Byrne was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah, she had a device that allowed her to manipulate human emotions. I'm reading this off of the fandom wiki.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because talking about that, well, sort of collected with this influencer thing was... like when I first read this, and we'd seen her visit Box at the beginning, but from his reaction after she left, as it's obvious he's trying to contact Department H or Mac to tell him about what's happening. So I assumed, oh, okay, he's going to be on the side of Alpha Flight, if you like. And then when I saw him here in the room with the others, I still thought, oh, he's kind of like a double agent here. He's pretending to be one of them, but he must be working for Mac, you know. But then when I read that bit about the influencer, then I thought, so maybe now he's under the influence of something. So maybe that's turning him to the bad guys.
Yeah.
The same, you know, the same as the rest of the group. Because the way this particular issue ends, where they all confront Guardian, and Box is there too, kind of joining in. And I thought he was going to be, you know, against these guys. Of course, he could have been, he could have been still playing the part of being on their side. But as I say, when I read this, I thought, so he's being influenced now. So if he is sort of acting as if he's an enemy, that's probably why. because it confused me a bit. So I thought, well, so is Box going to be with Alpha Flight or against them? At this stage, I was now unsure. I thought, what's he doing? He seems to be joining in with the bad guys there. So
well,
it was interesting.
We've seen this sort of a move before, Nigel. Mm. Not that it came this early, but we've seen this sort of sleight of hand in Avengers West Coast with the reveal of Magneto and the Darker Than Scarlet.
Mm. And Quicksilver, yeah.
I'm not saying that it's not effectively done, but at this point, I didn't have an opinion on Box. I didn't have an opinion on any of these folks, except, oh boy, Mac has flown into a setup. He's flown into an ambush.
Yeah. Well, I say it was just that, from the beginning of this issue, as like after he's been visited by Delphine Courtney, who seems to be successful in getting everybody else to agree to come on board, he obviously wasn't going to do from the way he was thinking, and he tried to contact Department H, etc. So I thought, Box is not going to buy it, which is why I was surprised to see him here where they're all meeting, because I thought, he didn't seem to be on board.
That may have been why Bert dropped the line about the influencer. To literally set you up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to say, before we leave page 9, what a difference 40 years makes that an irate Mac could go up to the Air Canada terminal without a ticket and confront these people about where his wife is. You know, nowadays, you couldn't get that far into an airport if you tried.
No.
Back when you can meet people at the gate.
Yeah.
Ironic that he was leaving here and going right to the Two Towers.
Yeah, that is ironic.
I'd say
now, I just want to know how he knew which floor 43 was, because how did he count them up, count them down? I mean, he went right into that window. That's some pretty good deductions there.
Well, he said he could tell where the signal was coming from.
Yeah, I'm going to say he can pick up on the signal.
Isn't he zeroing in on the signal?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did anybody else get Superman the Movie vibes from this? This is exactly what Luthor does to Superman with his sonic signal and the poison
with the
pellet thing he'd come up with.
Only you can hear me and all that. Yeah. And
instead of drilling his way into the ground, he melts his way through the window.
So we're agreed that melts the window, and he is now in one of the Twin Towers, right? Let's hang on to that for a moment. You ready to turn the page?
Yeah.
All right, we're over to 12 now, the splash at the end, where Omega Fight is assembled and revealed in all their glory. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 or 7, 8 of them. It's 8 against 1. The setup is that they are about to have their fight in the World Trade Center Tower, correct?
In the basement of the world, or some lower level.
Did he go down?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he got an elevator.
Yeah, there's the elevator.
Yeah.
Maybe in the basement. I'll hold my comment then till the next issue.
So technically there's only 5 there, because 3 of them are flashbacks duplicates.
But we don't know that yet.
Yeah, we don't understand the nature of his abilities, but just based on their costumes, you can tell that they're connected to him.
Yeah.
He's kind of like multiple man. He can summon future versions of himself.
Yeah.
When I read this and it was only page 12 and it gives that next issue blurb, I'm like, what the? And as I turn to the next page, I'm like, no!
Cheated.
Wanted more, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it was okay, because I did have the next issue. I didn't read them when they came out. I read them in the summer of 87, I think.
How would you have felt if you'd have been in my situation then? I was reading it as it came out, and I was like, not now. I thought, come on, you can't stop now. We've only had 12 pages.
I know.
Given we have 9 minutes left in this hour, or would you like to plunge forward and make short work of the last half of this issue?
Let's keep going.
I'll just say this. Yeah, the first page, that device that he's getting into, makes me think of what Bill Bixby got into in the Hulk TV series.
Exactly. The reason why.
I can hear that really fast piano going.
Dr. David Banner.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out that he wasn't a mutant here.
That's true.
When I read the story, he's not a mutant. Yeah,
he would have been a mutant.
No, he's not a mutant. No.
Well, my bigger question is he, you know, obviously they established that he's, well, I got two problems there. He's friends with Banner. And at one point he says it had only been 3 years or 2 years earlier that the public found out that Bruce Banner was the Hulk. Well, I looked that up. That was in Tales of Astonish number 77, and it was published in 1966. So even with that sliding time scale, it didn't seem like it'd be a much bigger gap than just 3 years.
Well, no, because he's talking 3 years from when he joined Alpha Flight.
How long he proposed he's been joined Alpha Flight?
A couple of years, I would think. A couple years at least.
All right, okay, maybe that works. My other question is,
because you remember these are all like flashback stories with a lot of different flashbacks, and this one's got a flashback within a flashback. So. That's like 16 flashes.
Yeah. And this is before, because he mentions in the story that Max says, if we go after Wolverine again, I'm going to need you, which would lead into X-Men 120, 121.
Or 109. You know, and I thought it led into a good potential story that I think Byrne was setting up, but maybe didn't intend to. Or would I would have liked to see him at this time finish, which was the beast that Snowbird was referring to and working out from underneath there. I mean, what were some of these mythical beasts that might have played into? And we kind of get into that later where we learn more about Snowbird and then, of course, in her origin story. But it's like, ooh, that sounds like that could have been a really interesting series, you know, 3 or 4 issue story arc. Exploring that those mythological beasts of, you know, the Arctic or wherever that influence Snowbird and maybe influenced Walter here to create this Sasquatch persona. So I wish maybe some other writer has worked on it, but I would like to see what John Byrne would have done with it.
Yeah, all I get, the sense I got here was the same sense I got from watching the Han Solo movie. You know, it checked all the marks of the origin for him that told you everything, you know, basically matched everything that you already knew about him. And so it wasn't like, I wouldn't say this is like one of those great origin tales. Of course, it doesn't give you all that information because we find out about the great beasts and everything later.
Well, and I'd forgotten how much they heavily hint as to what actually occurs. Instead of, I would have been, if I was Byrne, I would have been much more vague. So we would assume he is some kind of gamma spawned creature.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the Northern Lights or something that caused him to become, because he kept saying, I'm not green. But
yeah,
they pretty much kind of heavily imply, no, he may have breached the barriers that release some of these great beasts. So,
yeah.
It's not as but much because, of a shock later.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like the panels where they show the machine going on and the like partial skeleton and the red background and the transformational elements. I love that artwork through those couple panels.
It's beautiful. It really is beautiful, especially that skeleton panel in the lower.
Yeah.
The red and black background behind that, is that a close-up of a face or a beast?
I think it's a close-up of a skull.
Yeah.
Interesting story.
And even like that pose of Snowbird on page 18, where she's kind of using her cloak as like wings kind of thing. It is a very cool-looking look.
Yeah.
They
could do some really, if they were to ever produce like a Marvel-style film of Alpha Flight, especially with today's special effects, they could really do some. It would really look great because I think Sasquatch would have to be all CGI, but I don't think everybody else would have to be.
Yeah, I do want to, you know, basically say to all of the listeners here, we kind of want to know how issue 12 affected you. And we want to read, you know, basically I would like to read some of those reactions in our, you know, when we cover issue 12. So if you could, on the Facebook page, put in your own reaction when you read issue 12, when you read the big, you know, surprise, if it was, you know, how did it hit you? Was it a gut punch? What did it do? Or did you, like, roll your eyes? Whatever. Let us know. Also, we'd like to get your feedback on the current issue as well as any of the previous things we've done. You can always write us at gottagetburned@gmail.com. You can always write us on our Facebook page. We'll always have a post that corresponds to every issue that we do. And you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes. Is that everything? Did I cover everything?
I think that's it.
I think you did.
Yep.
All right. Well, we got 2 minutes left. If everybody would like to say their goodbyes.
We have a little bit more time to chat. Regarding Snowbird and her wings, I see that as animation, much like we've seen the Falcon in the most recent Captain America Brave New World movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I kind of like how they end this Sasquatch origin story with his grinning face. And it's like, well, there's only one thing you can do. Call me Sasquatch. And it mm-hmm. ends on a very happy note.
Mm-hmm. Well, he enjoys being Sasquatch.
What's to come without being too specific. So, I don't know. I like this issue. I enjoyed this issue. But it wasn't, I didn't have the impression that we were leading to anything. It was simply, oh, okay, here's an opposing team being introduced, being set up. That's what I got from it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go around the table and thank our panel of experts here, except this time I'm going to go around the other direction. I want to thank Nigel.
Thank you. Yes. Goodbye.
And we have Fred.
See you later, everyone.
And your guest, John.
Hey, yeah, it was fun. Great to talk about Alpha Flight.
And Brian Hughes.
Adios, amigos.
And of course, our editor par excellence, Tim Elliott, who's been so helpful over the last 10 years. Thank you, Tim.
Oh, you're welcome. It was always fun to get together, you guys.
And I'm Kirk Greenfield. Thanks for joining us, and we can't wait for the 12th issue. See you then.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Only one thing alive with less than 4 legs can hear this frequency, Superman, and that's you. In approximately 5 minutes, a poison gas pellet containing propane lithium compound will be released through thousands of air ducts in the city, effectively annihilating half the population of Metropolis. I know it all seems a bit much, but how else was I going to meet you, Superman? I knew you'd never accept an invitation to tea. But a disaster, with people in danger, people who need help. Well, I just knew you couldn't resist the chance to sort of pitch in. Know what I mean?